So what happened is I get an email saying that I had been rejected for a job at the Container Store. Now, my resume has on it, you know, a good college, best-selling author, Emmy Award. You know, it's a pretty good resume. Maybe not the best resume for the Container Store, but I first laughed when I opened that email. Like, I can't even get a job as a greeter at the Container Store. What is going on? And then I cried, and I cried a lot.
I'm Farai Chidea, and this is One with Farai, a show about how visionaries integrate life, work, and passion. That's best-selling novelist and memoirist Deborah Kopakin, who just sold her first book, Shutter Babe, to NBC.
You know, it didn't have to be the Container Store. It could have been any job. It just was just, you know, we always say to ourselves, you know, if worse comes to worse, I can always flip burgers at McDonald's. Or if worse comes to worse, I can always get that job as a waitress. Well, no. Not in this economy. It's not like you can just go and get a burger flipping job these days. It's hard to get a burger flipping job, and it's hard to get a job at the Container Store, and it's hard to get any kind of job. And I have three kids, and I had breast cancer, and I was sort of at the end of my rope, and it just was a breaking point.
What were the circumstances that led you as a best-selling author to apply to a job at the Container Store, and how did you process all this?
Well, in one word, desperation, and in a more detailed way, I had just separated from a 23-year marriage, a 20-year marriage, 23-year, you know, cohabitation. My ex had moved to California to start a business, so it wasn't like he was bringing in a lot of income at all. So basically, all of the childcare and the income for the family was on my shoulders, and I was in that place that you probably know well when you're mid-book. I had written 90 pages of a novel, and I was hoping to sell it once it had been, you know, 200 pages, but I wasn't at that 200-page point. So I had to drop the novel, and, you know, I earn a pretty good living when I do sell those, but you can't sell them until they're done. So I dropped the novel. I got a job at a health and wellness website that had health insurance, thank goodness, because then I was diagnosed with stage zero breast cancer last year.
And what is stage zero?
Stage zero is when a duct seems to be filled with some cancerous cells, but it's not spreading anywhere. I have to say, wasn't too frightened. I did a little research into it. It was not life-threatening. It just had to be dealt with. There were a lot of doctor's appointments. There were a lot of biopsies. There were a lot of MRIs. There were just a lot of stuff that was going on that took me away from my executive editor job. And I don't think my health and wellness website, though they were a health and wellness website, were all too happy with their executive editor being gone as much as I was gone.
They championed everyone else's health and wellness, but not particularly yours.
Yeah, I can't really talk too much detail about it because there were some lawyers involved. And when I did get fired, the first words out of the firing squad's mouth was, "We couldn't even find you to fire you." And I said, "Really? Because my only absences have been at Sloan Kettering." So that could be an actionable phrase. I would be careful with what you say. Anyway, I was on severance for that job for 3 months, and then the severance went away, and I literally sent out, I would say, 100 resumes, called everyone I knew, looked for jobs teaching, looked for jobs in magazines, looked for jobs in television. I was even looking for jobs in PR anywhere. I'm not trained to do PR, but as a journalist, you can
do
PR because you know.
Yeah.
So I looked high and low. I bothered everybody in my email inbox. I couldn't find a job. And I needed to get an MRI to check to make sure that my breast cancer was gone. And that came and went. I couldn't go because it's $6,000. And an email popped up into my inbox, and it said, "Container Store is hiring for the holidays." Just sort of a three-month, you know, work during the holidays. You would get health insurance. And I just thought, you know what? I love the Container Store. I can greet people at the door. I have a sunny disposition. I would happily wave to everyone, help them. I know that the greeter at the door is more than just a greeter, that they're there to spot potential thieves entering the store.
If you can hang out with the Taliban or fighters you did in Afghanistan, I'm sure you can take down a simple shoplifter.
Yeah, I spent 4 years covering wars. I think I can handle the Container Store.
I was joking with the producer of this show, Devin Robbins, that in hard financial times, which all people who freelance have, I have tried to sell everything except my pussy. You know? I keep that one.
And believe me, I've thought of that too.
I think that the people who want my private parts generally are not paying, and I don't want anyone to pay. I don't work the pole either, but you know, God. It's like I'm just like, what can I sell in my house? I'll put it on Craigslist.
The real tragedy of today's economy is that we were promised if we worked hard as kids and got into good colleges and studied and got A's and, you know, went on and did something with our lives, won awards and racked up all those accolades that you need to rack up so that you get the next big job, that you would be guaranteed work. And first of all, there was a total decapitation of the creative class. I mean, we are all running around like chickens with our heads cut off. And second of all, with the contracting economy, there just isn't enough room for all of us, and or at least enough room for all of us to do what it is we've been trained to do. And so in many ways, you are tempted to take your resume and doctor it down to make yourself look less smart, less accomplished. And what a tragedy that is.
Yeah. I'm literally a day away from finishing a book on work, and I have interviewed everyone from former drug dealers who are now welders and construction workers to billionaires. But the reality is that the middle is squeezed the hardest. You know, people, whether it's creative professionals, with the exception of certain groups like IT professionals and certain types of health professionals, are pretty much employable anywhere. But many other types of skills are essentially being taken over by bots or by people who don't have training in them. Meaning, journalism, when I went into journalism as a 20-something, I was being trained by people in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. And now you'll walk into a newsroom and the oldest person will be 35.
Oh, I'm the oldest person. I work at cafe.com right now, and I am the oldest person by far at age 48 than the rest of my comrades.
Yeah.
I am the oldest. I'm also the only one at this point with kids.
Yeah. No, things have changed a lot. And the economy, I will say, having been studying it, is growing. But what it's doing is it's growing at a much smaller rate, and 90% of people have seen a loss of real income. So it's technically growing, but when 90% of people are seeing a loss of real income, it's not really growing for most people.
Oh, I'm earning half of what I was earning just a year ago right now at my new job, and each book that I've done has earned less than the previous book. I mean, I also think it's a devaluation of art, which is so ironic because right now, it's particularly at a tough time, what do people turn to in tough times? They turn to art. They turn to movies that fill your soul, or they turn to music that makes you feel better. You know, art has always had a place for all of us, and we have devalued it to the point of absurdity.
Right. I think many more people, and I'm one of them, have learned to split their time. Like I write pieces for free on my own blog or sometimes for other people's websites. I write articles for pay, sometimes that pay very well, but rarely.
I know.
And I write books, which, frankly, the way that I do books, I always lose in the short run, and sometimes I win in the long run. You know, I do feel like when I started in journalism, we had a $50 late dinner allowance at Newsweek, which is worth $80+ today in current dollars. Now a lot of places won't pay $50 for an article, let alone dinner.
I had that at ABC and NBC, too. When you stayed late, you got money for dinner. They paid for your dinner. It would just come in. It would come to you.
Yeah. And I'm not trying to be completely Debbie Downer, but I do think that, you know, when you talk about your journey, we reconnected. You know, we both went to college together and overlapped in years at Harvard. But I'm always heartened, you know, now that I teach journalism, I'm heartened by the people who still want to do it.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many people who still want to do it, and some of them are desperately afraid of what this means for their career lives. But let's use that as a pivot to get back to who you were when you became a photojournalist. You
sure.
know, who were you and why did you do it?
So I went into war photography literally right out of college. So I had a wonderful teacher named Christopher James, at
so
Harvard.
Did
I love him.
Me
I just had an email from him yesterday. We're still in touch.
Please tell him I say hi.
I will. And then I also had Gilles Perez, who was a visiting professor from Magnum Photo Agency, and he was very encouraging and gave me a lot of contacts. And so I moved to Paris just with sort of some names and contacts and no other plans other than I'm going to move to Paris, where it is the center of photojournalism, and I'm going to find my way to a war. And I don't care how it happens, but it's going to happen. And I literally went around to all the agencies, none of whom would visit me. So I went to the Sigma agency, and I went around the corner to a cafe. And I sat there with my portfolio on the chair in front of me and my Leica around my neck, hoping that when the guys, because they were all guys at the time, would come by, they'd see me there pathetically sitting with my portfolio and my camera, and that they would talk to me. And I'd say, I would like to work with you. And of course, it never worked out that way. But they did notice me sitting there for 2 weeks straight, so that when I finally did get a meeting with the head of the agency, I walked in and everybody burst out laughing. They're like, there's the girl who's been sitting at the cafe. And I said, you know, I want to cover wars, and here's my portfolio. And the guy took a look at my portfolio, and he said, all right, where would you want to go? And literally he had a Libération, the new French newspaper, sitting on his desk. And the front page was Israel Intifada. And I actually hadn't thought of where I wanted to go. I thought nobody's going to actually ask me that. And I was like, I want to go to Israel, because I saw the newspaper right there. And he said, great, when do you want to go? I said, next week. He said, great, we'll pay half your expenses and half your film. Come back with good photos. And that was it. That was the beginning. And then I went to Afghanistan after that, and then the career sort of blossomed from there.
And out of all that, you wrote a memoir, Shutter Babe, about your experiences. But before we talk about the book, take me to a moment that you think exemplified both the good and the bad of what you did as a war photographer.
You know, the moment that always comes back to me is Valentine's Day, 1989. I'm sitting in the cave in somewhere in Afghanistan, and there's me and 40 Mujahideen, and we're getting along pretty well. You know, they have been kind to me.
Mujahideen being the people who were fighting the Afghan fighters who beat the
Soviets. Yeah. And did some of them become Taliban? Sure. These were the future, you know, members of the Taliban. But there were also some really unbelievably kind men there. And we were, you know, we did not speak the same language. I had one guy that could speak a little bit of English, but it was Valentine's Day, 1989, and the Pashto version of the BBC comes on. And I hear, you know, a language I don't understand, but it's blah, 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 Salman Rushdie, blah, 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 Salman Rushdie. And I said, why is a book review leading the top of the BBC tonight? And the guy who spoke a little bit of English, Hashim, said, Miss Deborah, Salman Rushdie, he write very bad book. And I said, okay, but why is it leading the BBC? It's, you know, and he said, we Muslim must kill him. And then they ran out of the cave and they started shooting their Kalashnikovs into the sky. And I'm sitting in the cave in my sleeping bag. You know, it was like late at night. It was 11 o'clock at night. I'm like, what the heck is going on here? What is happening? And I go outside and they're shooting off their guns into the sky, yelling, down with America, okay? And Allah Akbar and down with America. And I realized at that moment, you know, here we were giving them Stinger missiles, and here we were supporting the Mujahideen against the Soviets because it was all about communism and containment. But they didn't love us. Salman Rushdie, who was, by the way, neither American, he was Indian or he was British, depending on your cultural bent, but he was definitely not American. And here they were taking Salman Rushdie as sort of a representative of America, which is just some large metaphor for them. It's not even a place. It's not even a people. It's not even a country. I am American. I'm in their cave. They're being nice to me. I am the other. And it just made me think, oh, my God, what have we done here?
Yeah.
What have we done supporting these people? And even then, as the Soviets were pulling out, I thought, there are 8 Shiite groups and 7 Sunni groups, or opposite, 8 Shiite, 7 Sunni, I can't remember exactly, but they're all fighting each other. And they're all fighting each other to the death to become the next president, as Gulbuddin Hekmatyar would, of Afghanistan. And it was, we had left a fractionalized, crazy, unstable situation. And I told all my friends in America and in Paris when I got back, we have really effed up that country. And when 9/11 happened, I have to say, not that I was not saddened and horrified, but it was not so surprising.
Right, because you had been there and seen the way that the road to hell is paved with good
intentions,
global intentions, and sometimes just controlling global intentions.
Yeah.
You know,
one of the reasons I got out of war photography and in international journalism altogether is just like, at a certain point, the stories are all the same, and they just repeat, and we are destined to repeat history over and over and over again. And it was almost too depressing to handle.
Yeah. So it was Aldous Huxley who said that there's only one corner of the universe you can be certain of improving, and that's your own self.
Yes. It's a great quote.
And I believe that now. And it's horrible in some ways, but it's also liberating. It's like you can leave a footprint on the world, and you can be a good person, and you can advocate for others, but you cannot be certain that your actions will change other people's lives. And although that sounds disempowering, it's actually empowering.
Well, you know, I had a really interesting conversation with a mutual friend of ours, Dan Estabrook, who's a artist.
I have one of his paintings in my living room.
Yeah.
His photographs, sorry.
He said something that I just loved, and I want to get it right. He said, all this marching and all this protesting, when it comes right down to it, the best thing you can do politically is just raise good kids.
Mm.
And I just thought that was an incredibly powerful statement. Start at home. Start by raising the best possible kids you can who have grown up with compassion and with love and feel safe. And then you won't sort of sick them on the world in a way.
Yeah. But I don't have kids now. I would like to have kids and am in the process of examining adoption. But I believe that in general, I do think that raising good kids is a great way to impact the world, but also as someone who's mentored a lot of people, basically those one-on-one relationships often are more granular in terms of how you can change the world, whether it's...
Yes, fruit-bearing, very fruit-bearing.
Yeah, yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, to make people feel safe, loved, appreciated, and able to deal with their own journey is a pretty beautiful thing.
And I think that, you know, as I get older and older, that's what I do more and more, is I say, how can I help on a one-on-one basis? Because that's the best way to help. It really is at this point.
Yeah. The photograph I have from Dan Estabrook, who's done some wonderful photography and used a lot of older photographic media, and this one may be an albumen print, is of the, it starts at the neck and ends kind of at the legs of a guy sitting in the lotus position with his hands in what's called meditative equipoise, and just this image of a man sitting, without it being personalized by the face. And I love that photograph, you know, because I also find that, and we've talked about this at different times, that meditation and being able to be quiet with yourself is also another way, I think, that I have found of dealing with the chaos of the world.
Same. Yeah, I started out with yoga late, really, really late, after my dad died. My GP actually said to me, you know, try yoga. It's a really good way of not being depressed after a death in the family. And I said, oh, that's ridiculous. I'm not doing yoga. I'm not a yoga person. And lo and behold, he wrote yoga on a prescription pad and he handed it to me because he knows I'm a rule follower. I was like, oh, now I'm going to have to do it. Now I'm going to have to actually do it. And I did it and I have not looked back. I have literally done yoga every single day since he handed me that pad. And I try to sit meditatively with my thoughts as quiet as I can, and just focusing on the breathing. And, you know, science is proving us correct in this now. They're showing that it actually does change your brain.
It changes your brain, but also your body. And what I mean by that is I had a great chance to interview Elizabeth Blackburn, who won a Nobel Prize for Medicine. And meditation can reverse cellular aging.
Well, then amen. Right now, go sit on the floor and meditate.
I don't know that it's going to give you a facelift, but it might prolong your life. So you've done so many things in your life. I'm hesitant to, you know, go through your whole resume, but why don't you name a few of the projects, the fiction and nonfiction books and photography that you've done that you want people to know about?
Well, the first book I wrote, Shutter Babe, was a memoir of my years as a war photographer. That came out in 2001, and that's actually very new news. NBC Universal bought the rights to it. And in conjunction with Eva Longoria's company, Unbelievable, we are turning it into a TV show. And so I'm really excited about that. The second book I wrote was a novel based on a true story of my best friend who whose mother killed her and herself. And it's called Between Here and April. And it's sort of like a novelization of a real story because I couldn't actually write the nonfiction version of that because everybody who I needed to interview was dead. I wrote a book of humorous essays called Hella's Other Parents, which I really wanted to call Screwing in the Marital Bed. So think about Screwing in the Marital Bed when you actually read it, because it's really not a parenting book, but that's the title that they chose, Hella's Other Parents. And then the last book I wrote was about a 20th reunion of the Harvard class of 2009, which was neither my class nor your class. It was the Harvard class of 1989. And I was class of 88, and I think you were class of 80.
I was class of 90.
Class of 90. So it was the middle class because I figured all those people arrived, right after the recession, and I wanted to really focus in on what the recession and a sort of calamity version of the economy would do to these high-achieving Harvard grads. And that came out in 2012. And now I'm working as a writer full-time at a new magazine, which I really love, called Cafe.com. And why I love it is that it's so new that there's very little oversight. I have an editor, but we're essentially allowed to go nuts, to do what we want to do, to sort of let the real truth come out and not try to whitewash anything. And I'm really enjoying this sort of unvarnished, unfettered, shameless truth. And that's why I wrote the container story. And by the way, I don't think anybody else would have bought that. And I'm glad it went out there, and I'm glad that Cafe.com took the, was brave enough to publish it.
And it traveled through social media like wildfire.
Yeah, it did. It really did.
Yeah. Well, we do something on this show called Exquisite, where we have a previous guest ask a question of the current guest. So I'd like to play you a little something.
Sure.
Do you remember your first day of school?
I don't remember my first day of school if we're talking about preschool, but I do have a very, very vivid memory from that first year that must have happened within the first week or so, and it is this. I was a big fan of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, the show on PBS, and one day Mr. Rogers taught us, sitting at home, what a feather was. I had never seen a feather. You know, you're three. You're learning a lot quickly. So he picks up a feather and he says, look, it's got a stem and it's got this really soft part at the end. And he ran his fingers over it and he's like, look how soft it is. This is a feather. And I thought, I'm going to go find a feather. So I was being walked home from school by my friend Cammie's mother. Cammie and I are still friends, by the way. My preschool friend and I are still friends. So Cammie's mom, Mrs. Goldberg, was walking a group of us back from preschool to our apartment complex in Adelphi, Maryland, and I picked up what I assumed was a feather. I was like, I found one. I found a feather. And it had a tail, and it was really soft. And I said to Mrs. Goldberg, look, look, I found a feather. And she screamed because it was a dead rat.
I'm assuming it was what we would call a flat rat that had kind of desiccated.
No, I think it was just...
You picked up a heavy old dead rat and said it's a feather? Oh.
And I was wondering why it was drooping, unlike Mr. Rogers' feather, which stood up straight.
You are so cute. You are so cute. Oh, that sense of imagination. Or the future photojournalist. Oh, my gosh, yeah. That's hilarious. Yeah, kids. Oh, my gosh, that's so funny. Well, now you get to turn the tables. And for our next guest, who we will not tell you who it is, you get to fish a question out of your imagination and toss it to them.
Oh, I've got a good one. Tell me about your first experience with love.
Wow. We have not had a love question so far. We've had a love answer. Someone asked a question about greatest regrets and it provoked a love answer, but we've never had an actual love question.
I'm glad.
So I am really looking forward to this. So you'll find out the answer to Deborah's question on the next episode of One with Farai. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Deborah Kopakin is a best-selling novelist and memoirist who just sold her first book, Shutter Babe, to NBC. She's also a writer and editor at Cafe.com. You've been listening to One with Farai, a part of Soundworks from PRI. I'm your host and executive producer, Farai Chidea. This program is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins. Our theme music is by the band Betty. And we'd like to thank a few of our supporters, including Paula Puhak, Simon Fought, Lalita Tatami, and the Aaron and Sylvia Rothenberg Family Foundation. Visit soundworks.org to find other podcasts as well as past episodes of One with Farai.
One with Farai is supported in part by PRI's New Voices Fund, bringing new perspectives and personalities to public media. Donors to the fund include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.